November 4th, 2011, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the 99th Lullabot Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about Drupalize Me, kind of its history, a retrospective. We've had Drupalize Me for about a year now, and so we just thought it'd be nice to kind of get some people together and talk about where it started and where it's been, what we've learned, and yeah. So I'm joined here today with
Addison Berry,
Jared Ponchat,
Joe Schindelar,
and finally
Michelle Lauer.
Cool. And I'm Kent Bai. And yeah, this is basically our Drupalize Me team that's been kind of consistently on the project for the last year or so. And I guess a good place to start is, you know, why did we kind of go from the video model of selling DVDs and digital downloads to subscription-based service of Drupalize Me?
I think one of the main motivators there was simply because we put a lot of time and energy into creating those DVDs and the downloads, but then when we needed to update them or if there were things to change and stuff like that, it was quite the process to go back and redo it. And then, you know, and then you have to press new DVDs, and how do you update DVDs? Do you send people new DVDs? It's like, eh? So having the flexibility of having the videos just streaming online, and you know, we can add new stuff, we can swap stuff around as we create stuff, we can just spit it out. We don't have to wait for the actual like whole production process in terms of like pressing DVDs and all that kind of stuff. So I think that was from my perspective, that was, I think, the biggest motivation for sort of exploring the idea, because it did just sort of, I think, start as like an idea to explore and see what we could do with it. I don't think we had a grand vision at the beginning of like what the final product would end up being.
I think part of it was just that, like, you know, Lullabot's a technology company, and streaming video is kind of this hot new technology, and everybody was like talking about it, into it, and we were totally like, oh, we could probably do streaming video too. Like, what does that look like? We've got videos. Why not try to figure out a way that we can put those videos online and stream them like everybody else, YouTube and Vimeo and all these other sites are starting to do. So I think partially started out as just an experiment. Like, can we actually make this work?
Yeah. And I think the other sort of thing that was happening too is that the video downloads were getting to be about like in the order of 12 to 20 gigabytes worth of stuff to download at all. And I think it just also, you know, people like the convenience of being able to just kind of watch it when they need it, and they watch it once and they kind of get the most of it. And then, you know, just having to kind of manage all that, those files, and then people would, you know, have hard drives crash, and then they'd have to download them all again. And so it just sort of became this issue that it becomes kind of a convenience to kind of just pay a fee to have access to them, rather than pay a much larger amount up front to have the videos there. So yeah, I guess in terms of kind of building out the site, what sort of things, you know, looking back on it for about a year ago, what kind of jumps out as some of those big lessons that we learned, or some of the big memories that we have of actually building out the site?
I could probably answer this one for Joe real quick.
Oh boy.
Recurring payments suck.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they suck. I mean, it's kind of nice to get paid on a monthly basis, but I would say that they are definitely difficult. There's a lot of aspects of building a recurring payment system that you sort of just don't think about when you start building it. You know, we installed UberCart, we installed the recurring payment module, UC_recurring, I believe, is the module. And we installed that and started playing with it, and it was great. Like, recurring payments were recurring. We were getting payments on a monthly basis. But then we started running into a lot of things that we hadn't quite thought about from the beginning. Things like, what if we wanted to offer discounts to people on a recurring payment? And so it was really easy right away to say, sure, we can offer them, you know, half off on the first month. But what if we want to do something like give them half off for the first 3 months and then have it go back to the full price? And so that was something that we had to figure out how to deal with. There's also the, like, the payment system basically works by, like, giving you a role, and then when your payment doesn't go through, it removes the role. But that didn't really provide us much in the way of metrics for being able to track what was going on. So we had to sort of modify that so that we could track, like, when did somebody receive the role? When was the role removed? Did they remove it themselves, or was it removed because their payment failed? Did their card expire, or did their payment just fail to go through? As, like, all of these things that we hadn't really thought about. And I think in a lot of cases, until we actually encountered them in the real world and then went, oh, crap, we should figure out a solution to that.
Yeah. And also, I guess one thing that sort of happens with the payment is that it's hard to kind of give something like a month away for completely free. One thing I've noticed is that, you know, it's usually like a discounted, like, you know, a dollar or something for that we give people. What is the challenges there in terms of, like, giving away a free month, and, you know, what are kind of the trade-offs there?
I think the challenge there with giving away a month totally for free was that you could essentially get that, sign up for an account for that month without ever having to enter in your credit card information. And I think that provides a combination of weird things. One of them is it's like, it's weird to get a free month and not be charged anything, but still be asked for your credit card information. So that was a little bit weird. But if we didn't ask people for their credit card information, we couldn't bill them for the second month without being, like, at the end of the first month, having to send them an email and say, oh, your free month is almost up. Do you want to enter your credit card information now? And I think that is sort of the reason that we have, in a lot of cases, gone with a, like, instead of a free month, you can get, like, your first month for a dollar. So it's still super cheap, essentially free, but we can have you enter your credit card information. We can actually make a charge on the credit card, which means we're validating that it's a valid credit card before storing information and that kind of stuff.
And then the renewing aspect of it, so that you don't have to keep dealing with it, you know, then can come into play. But if we don't have that information, it's like we'd have to, like, bug you on a regular basis, you know, and it's awkward. It's just an awkward thing. And yeah, it's like one of those things you just don't really think about until you're actually trying to do it. It's like, huh, that's just weird.
Just another big sort of learning moment for us was I'm recalling, like, early conversations when we were thinking we should make a website where people can just watch all of our videos. We sat down and we were like, okay, well, we've got 11, at the time, I think it was 11 Lullabot Learning Series videos. We hadn't released the 12th yet. And we thought, well, we're making a website then for 11 videos. And, oh, let's take all the Do It With Drupal videos that we've got, and we'll add those to the site too. Anything that we've got, we'll put it in there. But it really was 11 Lullabot Learning Series videos is how we were viewing it. And so we thought, well, cool, let's stream 13-hour videos online. There was a moment in which we were sitting there saying, let's stream 13-hour videos online. But then we also, like, went to work, like, figuring out, well, how would you browse and experience these kinds of videos? And we architected and designed a site for a very small number of videos.
Very small number of long videos.
Yeah, small number of very long videos. And there was a lot of sort of pain both for our users and for us to try to make the switch when we realized, wow, streaming 13-hour videos is not a fantastic idea.
Do you guys remember trying to scrub through a video to, like, get to a specific point in a 13-hour video on a little, like, timeline that's, you know, a couple inches long on your screen? And you're like, yeah. You could generally get within about 45 minutes of what you were looking for.
Yeah, I think our longest one was like 7 hours, 6 or 7 hours. But we actually ran into this, like, thing where we're going to encoding.com and kind of encoding stuff, and it was actually breaking they weren't able to actually encode it. And I think that was part of the thing.
Nobody freaking encodes a video that long and monolithic. Like, the people don't put that stuff on the web. What are you people doing? And we're like, oh.
Yeah, I was definitely happy to see that switch
My
over.
Favorite
part of the transition was then turning all of those, what were chapters in those monolithic videos, into these series now where you could say, oh, that little snippet's what I need to learn. I already kind of know the stuff before, kind of know the stuff after, and adding just the little snippet to your queue so you could find it. I think it was an awesome decision we made.
Yeah, it turns out our users were actually more interested in the chapters to begin with. It's like, yeah, this chapter encapsulates the concept that I want to learn now. It's kind of the reason we actually did our DVDs, like, and divided them up into chapters.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we had this problem where, you know, the playback was a pain, the encoding was a pain. Like, there were just a lot of, like, technical pain points for having long videos. So we decided to chop them up into small videos, which was a fun exercise in of itself. And we came up with this idea of putting them into a series, because we have various series, like the Lullabot learning videos we broke up. But then, you know, we had other stuff. Like, I started putting in the command line videos. But that ended up leading to another problem, because the initial design that Jared had come up with was for a couple of really long videos, not for lots of small videos, and not for to have a distinction between what is it, a standalone video or in a series, or like, and so how do I find these? And so, like, we did it and we were all excited and, you know, playback was better and people were really happy, but then they were like, but it's so overwhelming, I can't find anything now.
Yeah, a giant page of screenshots of training videos isn't really that helpful for people.
Yeah, and I guess one of the other big changes that we did very early on was moving off of PayPal to authorize.net. Maybe we could talk about, you know, what type of limitations we were running into with PayPal and why we decided to kind of change the credit card authorization system.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of background on that. One of the things that you have to do when setting up some kind of recurring payment system is you actually have to store people's credit card information, which is sort of dicey business. You have to make sure that everything's PCI compliant and so forth. And one of the sort of easier ways to deal with storing people's credit card information is to actually not store their credit card information yourself, but have your gateway, so PayPal or authorize.net or whoever you're using as the credit card processor, to store a payment profile for that person. So in this case, PayPal, for example, was storing a user's credit card information. PayPal is PCI compliant. We just store a reference to that payment profile. And then when it comes time to charge them, it sort of depends on the gateway that you're using, how that charge actually happens. With PayPal, you store a payment profile and what they essentially call a payment plan. And so you, when you create the profile, you assign it to a plan. And that plan might say, bill this user once a month for $10. Once you've successfully billed them for $10 on a monthly basis, ping my website and say, hey, I billed user with the ID such and such. And then the Drupal website would make whatever changes were necessary. The other way that you can handle that is the way that we're doing with authorize.net now, is we store a payment profile, but Drupal is actually responsible for telling authorize.net when to bill someone and how much to bill them. And this allows us to do more of those complex scenarios, like, you know, 30% off for the first 3 months, or like $5 off for the first 5 months. Basically anything that we can come up with, because we're responsible for the code that determines how much to charge them and when. Whereas with the payment plan type stuff that PayPal had, it was like, we could set up a payment plan, but you're pretty limited. With PayPal, it was like the only kind of discounts we could offer were like, you know, some dollar value off the first month. So it was like a trial period kind of thing. But it totally didn't allow us to do things like discounts for 3 months or first month free, or to be able to do things like, if we have a user that's been around for 6 months and then they, you know, send us a birthday cake because they think we're awesome, and then we decide, what if we want to give them a free month because we think they're awesome? We couldn't do that with PayPal, but now with authorize.net, we could give them that free month and so forth.
Yeah, we have a lot more flexibility. I do a lot of the support stuff, and, you know, so there are lots of circumstances that come up where, you know, I'll extend somebody's account basically and like change, or we can just like very easily change the charge date. Like, some people really want to be charged, you know, like, I want to be charged on the 3rd because I get paid on the 1st and I want my charge to hit after my paycheck, kind of a thing. And we have a lot more flexibility with changing that stuff with Authorize since we control it, whereas with PayPal, we were kind of stuck. There is one disadvantage, though, to this, the way that we do it now, where the website, the Drupal site, is determining the charge rather than the gateway, like when that happens. And that's if you don't take certain precautions with your development environments, you can end up triggering charges out onto, you know, out to the gateway. The payment gateway is just seeing, I don't know, some website out there that has the proper credentials is telling me to charge these people. Like, that's all it's seeing. And, you know, if the dev site has proper credentials and you start sending stuff on cron, you end up doing a bunch of refunds and sticking your tail between your legs and having to apologize to people. So, you know, and yeah, we definitely experienced that. And we spent quite a lot of time running through and figuring out all of the various little places when it comes to development, the stuff that we want to shut down, because recurring payments, you know, they just want to keep recurring, and you need to be able to turn those off, but you need to be able to control it in development as well, because you want to be able to test it, but you just don't want it to run all the time. And I think it was something else, like with recurring payments, that we just didn't really, you know, until we got bitten by it, we hadn't really considered the ramifications of all of that stuff. Like when we switched from PayPal to Authorize, that was suddenly something we were taking responsibility for. So that was an interesting time back at the beginning of the year. Sorry to anybody out there who's been affected by that.
Yeah, so I guess that's the issue, is that having a, you know, the testing environment and a live environment, and both of them could potentially trigger payments when you don't want to double charge people or whatnot. But what was the eventual fix, or what kind of precautions did we implement in order to prevent any time a new developer would come up online and set up a testing environment or a local environment, you know, to have them go off and start charging customers?
I think one of the big things was, you know, we're storing a lot of information in our settings.php file that is like access keys and certain variables that, you know, the recurring payments module has a variable that's like, should I trigger recurring payments on cron run, true or false? And you can set it to false, and it'll basically skip triggering recurring payments when cron is run. But the big lesson, I think, or one of them anyways, was making sure that all of the settings that are stored inside of settings.php and then get put into version control should be the developer settings. So like false, you shouldn't use recurring payments. All of our access keys should be the developer version of those access keys, or they should just be left empty so that even if it tried to make a recurring payment, it wouldn't be able to because it wouldn't have the access keys and so forth. And then that's what gets stored in settings.php, in version control and so forth. And then only on the production server do you actually override that stuff and put in the actual credentials. That way, like when a new developer comes along and makes their first clone of the Git repository and then does, you know, drush cron, they don't accidentally charge everybody that hasn't been charged recently or charge them a second time.
Yeah, basically making sure we're using our settings.php to set all of the defaults to don't do anything. And so it requires an active thing to turn stuff on if you want to. So like if we need to test things locally, you can override that and turn it on. But obviously you need to sort of know what you're doing and make sure that you're not actually sending that out to the payment gateway. So generally we make Joe do all the testing for recurring payments. I think it makes us all quite nervous.
A couple of tips then for people that might want to do this themselves. Some of the things that I make sure, like before I do any testing on this stuff, is that I've gone through and disabled all of the gateways except for the test gateway. So I'll do that before I run cron. I also typically, if I'm testing anything that has to do with recurring payments, and I need to set that like trigger renewals to true instead of false, one of the things that I'll do is actually I have a script that will go through the database and basically like sanitize everybody's information so we can't accidentally charge them. And then I can like run cron, but it doesn't actually mess with people's real information. And so that's been helpful. But basically, it's just like double check everything. Initially, I would like unplug my laptop from the internet so that when I ran cron, I could charge people.
Yes, something to definitely be aware of when you're playing with recurring payments.
So I guess one of the other things that I wanted to ask Jared about is sort of the moving from, you know, a traditional wireframing approach to more of a rapid prototyping approach. Did you want to talk about that, Jared?
Yeah, we basically, once the initial design of the site was done, what I found, and I think it's probably different for every designer, but if you're a designer who has, you know, plenty of skill and sort of front-end development kinds of things, you might find what I found in this process, which is that in a lot of cases, it's so much faster and actually just better. You're working with real moving interactive things to implement the details of a design on the site itself, as opposed to making a PSD mock for every possible design scenario. So once the sort of the shell of the look and feel and the brand of the site has already been implemented, what we found is that things like implementing this new approach to how we were going to design a series, we could get together developers and myself, the designer, and sort of hash out ideas verbally of what are some ways we could approach this. I might go do some research into just patterns that are out there that other sites are using to find if there's any sort of consistent patterns that would create patterns that people are already used to for how you browse these types of things or whatnot. Discuss the ideas. If the interface itself is highly complex, I might do a quick static wireframe of some ideas of how we could approach it. If it's dead simple, it's not much to the interface in terms of number of elements and all that. A lot of times we might just discuss it and say, well, let's make this output in this type of a list and mark it up somewhat like this. And a developer could right away begin instantly building the thing, building a real thing. And then I could jump in once the real thing is there and begin to style it. And I think that Michelle and I have taken that approach for several things now, where here and there I'll do a wireframe. If I already have a PSD that exists that's very close to what we're doing, and it's faster to go ahead and just modify that PSD to show the example of what we're where we're headed, I'll do that, just because the whole goal is efficiency. But in a lot of cases, I feel like we make better decisions working with real working things. So I've actually really enjoyed this sort of we refer to it as rapid prototyping, and it's basically, I mean, there are other design firms and whatnot that do rapid prototyping all the time, and that usually means like they build like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to like show something that's a pseudo working thing or something. We're sort of rapid prototyping with Drupal as our rapid prototyper, where we use Drupal and we actually just make something, and then we begin to style it and tweak it as necessary when we find the pain points. But it lets you sort of start from that starting point of what Drupal wants to do as well, and lets you sort of pick your battles. So I think it's worked well. I don't know if Michelle has thoughts on that.
I was going to say, it works really well for me, because if I'm developing a front-facing new feature, you know, I just worry about getting the data in there and a kind of a best approximation of the design. Some things are floated correctly, but I don't spend the time on the details of the rounded corners, the shadows, the fonts, and things like that. We just get it up there first to make sure it's working correctly, and Jared can come in and then smooth things out and put those final details that actually make it the complete experience. So as I'm developing, it works really well for me, because I'm not focusing on some of those little things. All I need to worry about is I need to get the content, the data, the variables, all that displaying in the right place at the right time. And then, so yeah, as a two-team kind of like tag team approach, I think works awesome.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I just keep thinking about this type of an approach to web design is that I have never had a user of a website come up to me and said, if I had only had the PSD for this site. Like, it's one of these weird things that you put lots and lots of time into in the web design process that's a total legacy item. It doesn't exist out there. Nobody interacts with it. Nobody does anything with it. So just from a simple efficiency standpoint, it's like any way that you can avoid making a PSD, I recommend it.
So what do you do instead of the PSD? You just sort of build it out? Is that what you're saying, Jared? I guess I'm trying to figure out terms of designing and making it look a certain way.
In instances like the new browse interface, I think we actually with that one, it was complex enough. We were trying to decide which columns to include and whatnot. Lots of elements, lots of potential columns. So I did like a really quick, like lo-fi wireframe, just little gray boxes on a screen. And we used that as sort of a discussion point so that we would know what someone meant when we were like, well, this, let's not include this in this version yet because we don't have this ready from a development standpoint or whatever. And we basically went right from a lo-fi wireframe, it's essentially like a really rough sketch, to Michelle actually dove right in then and started building something. And then I would look at what she's making and evaluate like, oh, okay, as we're seeing this working, is there anything that we need to tweak or should we be revising from here? And this, so this working thing itself became the wireframe essentially.
There have been other times too where we're doing a much smaller feature release for something where Jared will just verbally tell me, I want this data placed here. No wireframes needed. And it's just the verbal discussion of where things are going to be placed and the kind of information I need to get out of, you know, template.php is way faster than him doing an entire mock-up for something.
Yeah, we also do sometimes do that in tickets. It's like, oh, I don't know, where should this go? And well, I don't know, here's an idea and let's do that. And then it's always like, there are a lot of tickets where it ends up, you know, there's a lot of work that gets done and building that happens, and then it's like, okay, let's kick this ticket to Jared, and Jared comes back and either says, oh, well, I don't know, or, you know, but most often it's like, okay, well, that's the stuff that's there, so now we just basically need CSS, you know, and just and polish it up. I think it's been a really nice flow as well.
Too. And I think it's actually, so I think our sort of our motto or to our method is make something, because we want to get something out there and let users interact with it. And I think as a designer, I'm learning more from what people are saying. And when we discover big pain points, it's really noticeable, but at least we haven't burned a ridiculous amount of time on things that aren't actually used. Then we've made something. And if it's not working well, we iterate on it, which I think is a really nice process.
Yeah, definitely tossing something up there, like, you know, we did do like the series, like it was a feature and it was a big feature and it was a lot of work and it was a huge help on the site, but it wasn't fully baked in the way that we actually implemented it. But yeah, we could just turn around and be like, okay, well, so we have this that we're starting with, go and make it better. And I think we are a lot more responsive to, not just in terms of like what we want, because obviously we have like our plan of what we want, but we are a lot more, I think, responsive to, you know, member needs. I mean, like members tell us when, you know, like this interface sucks, you know, or whatever. I mean, they don't tend to say that. People tend to be a little nicer about it. But you know, when people do come up and that, where they say like, it would be really nice if I could do X or something like that, it's nice because, you know, we know that we can, you know, we can, once we prioritize that into our sprints, it's pretty fast to turn it around, because we just sort of slap something up, polish it off, put it out there, and then people say, that's great. Now it would be really great if it could also do this, or if this was like that, and then we can come back and iterate on it really, really quickly. So overall, I really like the flow that we have with working on stuff now, which has taken us quite a while actually to figure out. I think that's something else that we've been figuring out over the last year, is and part of it has to do with resources, I think, and part of it has to just do with playing around with different ways of sort of managing the work that gets done. Because when we started, it was very much like who has free time in Lullabot to work on this? Because it was an internal project, you know, we have all of our client work that was going on. And so we would, you know, dedicate hours here and there from folks, but we had a lot of people coming in and out and in and out and in and out of the project. There were a lot of hands on this project, especially at the beginning. And like when something was done was just sort of like when, you know, we sort of thought maybe it was, I don't know, good enough to stick up there. And everybody was just, we were just basically all working in master. We use Git version control, and everybody was just working in master, and you would just put your stuff in master. And then when somebody needed to put something that they were working on or a bug fix out on the site, it would go. I mean, it was like all of these kind of best practices that, you know, that we tell our clients, we sort of really weren't doing ourselves.
There's usually an evolution to a project, though. I think there does seem to be a bit of overhead that comes with doing best practices when mm-hmm. you are kind of doing it in your spare time and trying to get just something that works. So, I mean, that's to me, that's kind of an interesting evolution. But what was the tipping point, or what was the point in which we switched over when it became a necessity, I guess, in order to do a lot of those best practices?
Well, I think basically, you know, we put it together as an internal thing. We kind of worked on it for, we'd started it, then it sort of got like shelved a little bit, and then we sort of came back and kept working on it last year during 2010, I guess. And then finally we were like, you know what, this is good enough. We have working stuff. We have videos. Let's get it up there so people can start using it. And so that's when we launched it in November. And then it was just sort of like, I don't know, stuff's going. But then, it's like, well, it has legs. We have members. We need to be responsive to what people are saying on the site. And we want to improve it. And we want to do these things. And we need to sort of focus a bit more and sort of think more about like having resources and processes around it rather than just this is an internal thing we're going to try. And then earlier in the year, like right after Drupal, right around DrupalCon Chicago or whatever, Matt and Jeff basically anointed me as like the product manager because they were like, we need someone who can just make decisions and keep going with it. And so that was, in a lot of ways, like in terms of just like making decisions, like, what is the priority? What are we going to work on? Those kinds of things that helped. But I think when we brought in, we have two people within Lullabot who really know their project management stuff. And so Rachel Scott helped out some and Seth Brown came in for a while. And Rachel didn't have enough, she was working on other stuff, so she's sort of coming in and out. And Seth really had like a set period of time with us, like in the beginning of the year. And he really sort of laid down, he didn't come in and like lay down the law, like, what are you people doing here? But he really was like, he really worked with us to sort of, I think, figure out like what it is that we were trying to accomplish and what were good methods we could use. And we went through a lot of different stuff in terms of like the whole project management, code management phase of things. Like we've always used version control, but the whole idea of like, well, let's like actually like think about how we're going to do branch management. Like what is a release? When does code go up onto the live site? You know, how do we make those decisions? Introducing sprints. We have sort of a pseudo agile process now, I think. We have sprints that are, I guess, they're 3-week sprints. It's sort of 2 weeks of full-on work and then 1 week of QA and launch, which we sort of settled into. But just going through all those things, it's like, well, I don't know, do we write up user stories at the beginning? Like how much agile stuff did we want to use? How much of it was too much overhead for a small team just trying to like kind of crank stuff out? So we went through a lot of different things like that, but I feel like we're in a good groove now. And I think like the stuff with Jared is talking about with this rapid prototyping, it fits very well with the style of project management that we're using now, where we just sort of try to keep really light on our feet and try to keep responsive and not try to bite off too huge of a chunk. Because we found that like, particularly with design, because we always like to have Jared's input in terms of the UX. Like we want to make sure that we aren't just going to roll out a new feature and throw something up there that's completely like unworkable for a human being to use. So we would always be like, okay, Jared, we have all these features and we need you to tell us what to do with them, And it was sort of, becoming a thing where it was like, we can't do anything until Jared's done something with it. And I think that was part of the frustration, is not the right word, but I think that it just became this thing where it was like, there's so much to be done and we just want to keep moving. And that's when Jared was like, you know what? Screw it. Like, let me just like knock out some ideas. Let's talk about it. And let's just like keep rolling with it. And I think it's been awesome because I think we really do move a lot more quickly now. And I think we're doing really good stuff, but I'm also biased. So there's that.
Another thing that got mentioned in this discussion was that some of the UX changes that we've made were because people using the site actually wrote to us and said, hey, can you guys make a change to this? It's not working well for me. And that's something that I've seen us do a lot, is really listen to what our customers are saying, whether it is about the usability of the site or what videos they want us to produce. I mean, we have a list of videos that we want to get out, you know, every week, a couple more, but we make the priority for those videos based on, you know, what you guys are saying out there. And I just think that's awesome that being a part of a group that really listens to our customers using the product.
One of the things like Michelle's talking about, like that we haven't really talked about yet, is also the content. Like the team that's, you know, working on building this site, you know, we're also a lot of the people who are doing the development of the site are also creating the content, and so it becomes a matter of like weighing out, you know, are we putting out new features on the site, or are we going to put out new videos on, you know, theming, and like trying to juggle that stuff, and again, like what customers are saying, what members are saying and asking for, definitely weighs in terms of how we prioritize our weeks. You know, it's like we have a sprint coming up, and these are the things, these are the pain points that are out there, or these are the real needs and desires, and let's just move in that direction.
Yeah, I was going to ask Joe and if you had any other thoughts in terms of, you know, how the development process has kind of evolved over the time that you've been working on the project, because I know you've been kind of on it since you've been at Lullabot.
I think mostly the same things that Addie was saying earlier. Like it was awesome having Seth and Rachel in turn come onto the project and sort of provide us with some guidance and what it means to actually have a project manager and manage a product. You know, it's always that, like, you're always your own worst client, right? And so I think initially we were totally our own worst client, and it was like we would have different people on and off the project on like a weekly basis, and we would end up spending so much time just getting someone up to speed on what happened last week that they would only get to spend half of their time actually working on the project. And then once we sort of like figured out some of those different pain points and sort of documented our approach to things like how we're going to do version control on the project and how we're going to run our sprints and how we're going to manage tickets and so forth, it really made a difference in how productive we could be.
Yeah, and I remember too, also at the very beginning, having an internal project, there's this dynamic where you kind of have a project owner and then you have the development team. And I think at the beginning, we had Jeff Robbins as kind of sitting in as the product owner. But what exactly happened, Addie, to kind of put more power in your hands in terms of like making those decisions? Like, what was it that we kind of switched in order to kind of like have you more in control?
Well, I think really it was just that there were, you know, we were working on the project and just sort of trying to get it done. But we would end up in these situations where it's like, well, I don't know, what should we work on? You know, what is a higher priority? Or what is the, you know, we'd come to kind of stopping points where we had blockers and we needed to have decisions made. And you know, Jeff he's an owner of Lullabot. He's really busy and he's got a lot of different people sort of bending his ear. So he ended up beginning to feel like he was a bottleneck for us to be able to make progress. And so basically, you know, he and Matt just sort of came back and they're like, look, you're in here, you're doing stuff, you're already, you know, trying to funnel the questions and stuff. So why don't you just cut it off and why don't you just start making decisions? You know, we trust you to figure it out. And if you feel like you don't want to make a decision, then bring it up to us and we'll work it out together and that kind of a thing. But it was really just an empowerment thing. Like I was handling a lot of support requests that were coming in, but I didn't feel confident that I had the authority to make a call and actually do something. Like, you know, this problem's, you know, this person's been having a horrible, horrible, you know, problem or whatever with their, you know, getting access or something like that. Like, do I have the authority to give them a free month? I don't know. And so it was just sort of, I think, trying to just sort of clarify that kind of thing and say, yep, you have the authority, go with it. So I think that was really it. And I was doing client work as well at the time, but knowing that I sort of had the authority and I got, you know, hours set aside, you know, weekly to really focus on it. Because again, prior to that, everybody sort of, it was very hodgepodge in terms of when you could work on something or not. You might be on it on Drupalize Me for a week and then not. But then later on in the summer, I was put on the project full time. So I spend, you know, all day, every day, thinking about Drupalize Me and figuring out what we need to do and handling the decisions that need to be made. And I think that, and I guess the rest of the team can answer this question in terms of how it may or may not have changed for them. But I know for me, it made me feel like we could just get stuff done. Like we could just keep rolling and we could just, you know, make stuff up. Sometimes it was just a toss up, like, I don't know, but let's just pick one and just roll with it and see what happens. And if it doesn't stick, we'll come back and we'll iterate through and we'll do something else. But I think it just sort of accelerated everything to finally be like, you know, we don't have to run it all the way up the chain. We can just be a mobile team and make our decisions amongst ourselves and go.
I think another benefit is because you're 100% entrenched in the project and the team, you know us really, really well. So when it's time to, you know, assign tickets at the beginning of a sprint, you've kind of created niches for each of us where we are, you know, most effective, most efficient, and we get to do the type of development that we actually like to do, whether it's, you know, putting out a new theming feature or working on videos and how they're actually delivered and things like that. And I think that's just been wonderful. It's like, you know, the beginning of a sprint, when I get my my tickets, I'm like, oh, yay, I got a really good one. This is going to be awesome. And that's because you're just so intimate with the project.
One thing that I'm curious about is sort of like the codifying of the release cycle and the release cycle management, going from dev, staging, and live. Again, this is one of those things that changed from the beginning. We didn't have this system that we have now, but maybe we can just kind of talk about like, what is our release cycle management processes that we're using right now?
Well, we use Git. Version control matters. And we've always used version control. Like, that's just a lullabot thing that we've always done. So we've always had our stuff in version control. But really, we, like I said, we were originally just sort of all working. We would all just work directly in master and commit our stuff to master.
It was total chaos. Like, you check in, you commit something, and then like, 5 minutes later, it automatically showed up on the development server, whether or not it actually worked. And then you're like, oh no, the development server is broken. And everyone would like have to stop what they were working on it and fix that and get it working again. And then every once in a while, it would be like, all right, the development server looks like it's mostly working. Let's make a copy of that and put it on the production server.
Yeah, it was a little... It's a little fly by night, I think.
This is back in the days when we still had the restore option for backup migrate on the live site.
Yeah, that was another learning experience for us, wasn't it? We won't mention any names, but somebody accidentally restored a development database onto the live site, and that caused a little bit of mayhem.
Working with involved. SSL, like it the security module in Drupal just automatically redirects you to the SSL set domain for the HTTPS version. And so even if you're on the development site, when you log in, you get redirected to the real site.
Without knowing it, unless you're paying very close attention. Yeah. So now we have environment indicator on our sites. And again, like we have things set up so that like in settings.php, environment indicator is set to the local development. And we did also do a little bit of work to remove the restore option on the live site. So you can't, because we use backup and migrate. I guess we should be clear about that. Like we're talking about, we use backup and migrate module. And it was just easy, especially for bringing people in. Just, you know, we'd give them a login to the site and then they could just grab a copy of the live database to bring down for development. And so we just sort of got used to using that. But backup and migrate also has a restore tab, and so you can click restore and just through the UI you can restore a database and wipe out your existing one and replace it. And having access to backup and migrate on the live site is nice because it's very easy for someone to get a copy of the live database to work for development. It's not good to be able to restore through the UI on the live site, so we've removed that option, and you have to override locally if you want to turn that on. If you want to use that locally, yeah, that was good times. Lessons learned, but yeah. So back to the release cycle. Yeah, it was mayhem. and then actually it was Seth who, when Seth first came in, he was sort of like, so how does it, you know, how do we decide that code is going up to the live site? And we all sort of shrugged and like, I don't know, if someone does it. Like, and he was like, well, you know, let's sit down and actually think about it. And so we actually took some time to sit down and think about it, which was great. And what we ended up deciding to do, and I don't know if it's necessarily an ideal circumstance, it works well for us for now. We may revisit. I know there, like, I've talked to other folks in Lullabot and they're like, well, you know, you could do this other ways. And so we may end up revisiting it. But the way that we do it now is master is basically what we use for dev. So we have a development site that's up on a server, and it pulls in whatever is in the master branch on Git every 5 minutes, does a database update, wipes everything, like, you know, so that the dev site is always sort of the latest code that's in master. But in order for the code to get into master, to get onto the development site, it has to pass through me. I do branch management, I call it. But pretty much every time there's tickets, there's code, everybody does a branch, so you can just have like your own branch, but most of the time people make branches either per sprint or per ticket. Particularly if we have like a hot fix that needs to go up, someone will just create a hot fix branch that has the fix. So when I'm reviewing tickets, what I do is locally I go through, I check out their branches, test things, I merge it into master, make sure that the merge works okay. Sometimes we get conflicts, those have to be cleaned up. And then I will test it locally on my local version and make sure that it's working and hasn't, you know, blown stuff up. And if it's working, as far as I can tell, then I will push that to the master branch, and then that gets onto the dev site within 5 minutes. So that's how we do our development work. People work on tickets in a branch. I do all of the merging into master. Nobody else merges code into master unless basically they have approval from me to do so. Like if I'm busy or I'm out or something like that. And then when it comes time to put the code onto the live site, we have sprints. So we have a code freeze date, which we're recording this. We're currently in a code freeze and doing QA. And then we'll do the launch. And so for launch, I go in and I merge master into our live branch. We have a live branch. I tag it, and then I go up onto the live site and update the code basically up there. We have a script that does that. I just go in and put what the new tag number is and then run the script, and it'll pull down the new tag and update everything and all that good stuff. So that's how we're doing stuff now. But basically everything sort of has to go through me. I sort of do an initial QA just to get it onto the dev site. And then we do a full QA. The entire team does QA on the dev site for each sprint to kind of review all of our tickets and all of our stuff and see it all in one place. And then once we all agree, like, okay, that's good to go, then I'm the one who actually puts it onto the live site.
I think, too, just remembering that maybe even beyond like what our specific process is that we use for the site, just like having a process is what we sort of realized was important. So it was like previously it was sort of just this chaos, and you know, we had a process, but our process was like, whoa, whatever the process happens to be this afternoon. And actually, like, having a defined process and going, just like, we went through the act of actually documenting it and sort of like writing down, like, this is what our process is going to be. And that way, like, those of us that were already working on the project, it was awesome because now we know, like, okay, this is how we're going to do code promotion and that kind of stuff. It also meant that when this scenario of, like, you know, there's a few of us that are on the Drupalize Me project pretty regularly, and then there's a bunch of people that are kind of in and out of it depending on when they've got time and such. And so we're kind of always bringing in new people for a short period of time, and having it actually like written down and documented made it a lot easier for us to like get people involved with the project and not have to spend half a day being like, okay, this is the branch that you use for this, and this is where you check things in, and this is who's responsible for what portions of it. And so just having a process and documenting what that process is awesome.
Yeah. Like I said, this is the process that we use, and I don't know if it's the best one. And we're certainly like, we made some modifications, although I think we kind of settled into this and it's worked well for us. And I think that's the important thing. It works well for us. We feel like we know what's going on and we get the job done. So yeah, I totally agree with Joe. You just need some sort of process in place that everybody understands so you don't end up having, you know, three different people doing three different things.
Right. Yeah, I guess one other thing that the Drupalize Me team's been involved with is actually developing or designing and having a contractor help develop an iPad or iPhone and iOS app, I guess, and then also an Android app. So maybe we could talk a bit about that process and what was involved with that.
Yeah, and hopefully by the time we post this podcast, the Android app will be out on the market. I actually wasn't involved as much in that. And Eric Duran actually was on the development side, worked a lot with Summit. He's a Drupal guy who's been around for a long time. A lot of people probably would recognize him. He goes to a lot of the conferences. His handle is Summit K. And so he actually did all the app development with us. And Eric Duran helped on the dev side, and Jared worked a lot on the UI side of things and trying to figure out how to make it actually look like an iPhone app and how it was supposed to behave.
Yeah, and I guess the big lesson learned is if you want to get a paid subscription app into the iTunes store, you need to like learn to hold your tongue in just the right way and dance around and do a lot of crazy little things and then submit 6 times because it's very difficult.
we had a few difficulties. Yeah. We had a lot of back and forth with Apple trying to get our app approved. That was so painful.
Yeah, I think they're especially strict on video streaming apps and then subscription apps. And then if you have a video subscription app, both of them together, they just sort of like a lot of restrictions about what the app can and cannot have in it. And so it just seemed to be like a trickle effect where they would come back and come with one thing that they found and then we'd fix it. And then there was another thing and just kept on being this thing.
It's like those old forms from like 1995 where you go and fill out a form on a website and it asks for like your address and your phone number and your email address and you fill out, but none of the fields are marked as required. So you add like your first name and your last name and then you hit submit and then it shows you the form and it's like, oh, you need to add an address. So you add your address and hit submit. And then it's like, oh, you need to add a phone number and you add your phone number and hit submit. And it's like, just tell me all of the problems at once and I'll fix them all in one pass. Like, it was like, you could change something and then submit the app again. And they'd be like, oh, by the way, we forgot to mention this thing too. It's like, oh man.
Okay, now that you fixed that, now fix this, and wait days and days in between for those now fix this messages.
Yeah.
Loads of fun. Turns out it was pretty easy though to get a nice experience in a working iPhone app, and it's just hard to get in the store. It's been harder to get a working Android app, even though once it's working, it's not hard to get those into the Android marketplace.
What do you think the difference is? I mean, I guess their developer Summit has been using the Titanium framework to do both the iPhone app and the Android app, which I guess is sort of a JavaScript, you know, framework that you can use instead of writing native code. But what's the difference between the process, you think?
I'm not really sure. We would really need Summit or Eric Duran on probably to explain what the headaches have been. I just know that it's been disappointing to when we released the iOS app to have to tell people, sorry, there's not an Android app yet. But it's just been challenging to get everything actually working in Android. We've had more bugs with playability and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that there were just like the framework in terms of what we were doing or whatever, we just ended up running into more bugs with it. But, you know, also it has to be said that we did prioritize the iOS app over the Android app. In terms of like we had a limited number of, you know, hours and time to be able to do it. At a certain point, we're like, okay, let's not keep working on Android. Let's get the iOS one done and then we'll do the Android. And then the Android one it's just been a matter of getting back around and getting those bugs cleaned up and getting it released this week. So hopefully we're good now. But yeah, I don't know what all the technical details are about why we had more bugs in there. And, you know, I bet you there's people out there going, no, it's not buggier. You people don't know what you're doing, you know, which is quite, yeah. You know, quite possible, at least in speaking for me, not for Summit. Yeah, it's been an interesting process dealing with the app, because like we sort of chug along, like we're doing the website, and you know, and Summit's, you know, working on the app, and then he's, you know, went in and, you know, because we had to set up we set up services, and we have like views that are specific for the apps as opposed to the views that we're using on the website. We could reuse some of those things. And so it's just been an interesting sort of like, oh, there's this whole other thing that's sort of going on out there. And the fact that we managed to do it, I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess one other thing to kind of bring up is the kind of the origins of the Videola distribution is very much connected to Drupalize Me. And I guess, Joe, at some point you went out to Rhode Island with Blake Hall and kind of had a big sprint. And I think Michelle may have even been there too. I'm not sure. But maybe you guys could talk a bit about, you know, that process.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we sort of realized early on when we started building Drupalize Me was that, like, maybe sort of as a byproduct of building this website for hosting and streaming all of our videos and putting them behind a paywall, we might be able to come up with a more generic version of it, or a distribution in a sense that we could reuse on other projects as well. And so that's sort of like, as we got more and more into building Drupalize Me, we kind of looked at it with an eye towards like, what are the things that we can learn from this that we might be able to abstract a little bit further and turn into a distribution. And that's what is starting to become Videola at this point. Videola and Drupalize Me aren't one in the same, but they're related in that they attempt to solve a lot of the same problems, and they both sort of learn from each other.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Drupalize Me is really a lot of R&D for Videola, in a sense, like, and it was interesting because of, I mean, that it had a total impact on our development process for Drupalize Me. It took us a lot longer to get things going because we kept, like, stepping back and thinking about, like, well, how would we abstract this? Like, if we wanted to make this a distribution so that other people could do this too, how would we approach this? And so, and we ended up going down a couple of blind alleys, I think, in that process of like, well, this would be a lot more flexible, so let's try and do this. And then we'd be like, I don't know, it's kind of confusing. And then we'd back up, you know. And so it was a really interesting development process, especially early on in the project, as we were trying to keep this like really broad world view in terms of how we were building the site and snapping it together, rather than just like, you know, this is just a, you know, our one-off custom thing. And it was sort of a fascinating experience, but it did definitely take us longer and get us mm-hmm. stuck in some places where we were like, oh, you know what? I don't think this is such a good idea, really. And we experimented with a lot of things that we hadn't actually played with before, which was also nice. But and so I think we did learn a lot of lessons doing that have benefited both Drupalize Me and Videola, because I think we explored a lot of things and feel good about some of the decisions we've ultimately made with Drupalize Me because of the experimentation. And Videola, you know, got to basically have like all of this R&D. So the stuff that went into Videola, it's like, okay, this is solid. Okay, we've got this sort of, you know, fairly well figured out. So, you know, and we continue to sort of like, as we do stuff on Drupalize Me, you know, that's, we're much more focused on Drupalize Me now. But that's not to say that it doesn't still have the R&D impact for Videola.
It's awesome because it's sort of like real world testing too. Like, you know, we started out early in the podcast talking about some of the pain points of doing recurring payment. And a lot of that is stuff that like we just wouldn't have realized until we got to that point, until we had been around with our business model long enough that we realized like, oh, we might want to try doing X, or until we got that one customer that came along and said, you know, I really need you to be able to do this thing that we just wouldn't have thought about. And so having that real world experience for a lot of these has been awesome. And it's given us the opportunity to really sort of figure out, as we start considering how to abstract these ideas a bit more. How can we make sure that we're really solving all of the problems and not just the few that we can anticipate?
Cool.
Totally.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think that's probably at the point where we could probably wrap up. You know, it's been a great year, I think, for Drupalize Me and for all these, you know, just kind of getting all this stuff out there and all the content and, you know, continuing to update and just sort of improve the site. And we just thought it'd be a kind of a nice thing to get together and do a retrospective. So thanks, everybody, for getting together to do that. So yeah, with that, I guess we'll go ahead and sign off and, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody.
Woohoo! Bye.